At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
President Trump was on the road again today, stumping for his tax plan.
At the very center of that plan is a giant, beautiful, massive, the biggest ever in our country, tax cut.
Well, let's talk about that, shall we? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Risnow. Friday, the 29th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Here you go one more time, just because it was so good. The president on his tax plan today.
A giant, beautiful, massive, the biggest ever in our country, tax cut.
There are a whole lot of questions to be asked, and many already asked that have yet to be answered about the GOP's tax plan, so let us discuss, shall we? Catherine Rampell's at The Washington Post. David Gura is at Bloomberg. They are both in our studios in New York. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Catherine, here you go. Question number one goes to you, and it goes like this. For whom does the tax cut bell toll in this plan? Who gets the money?
There are tax cuts basically across the board, but the bulk of them go to the very, very wealthy. There was a preliminary analysis released today by the Tax Policy Center that looked at the distribution of those tax cuts, and half of the value of the tax cuts went to the top 1%. So half.
Yes, to the top 1%.
Keep repeating that,
yes.
which cuts their their tax bills by, I think, an average of like $129,000. And that's just next year alone. So, you know, they're heavily weighted towards the rich.
But, David, the president has promised, and the Secretary of the Treasury, rather, has promised that there will not be tax cuts for the wealthy in this plan. Where do we go from here, then?
Yeah, here we get into this issue of dynamism or dynamic scoring.
Oh, you're going to go there?
You are going to go there.
Wow. It's only a five-minute segment, pal.
I will. I'll pick up the same paper that Catherine was citing just a moment ago, and I'll try to get it right. Or Len Berman's going to give me a call to critique what I have to say here. But you know, they're pointing out huge revenue losses, a reduction in revenues, and you have Steven Mnuchin, you have Gary Cohn saying, in fact, we're going to see that increase, and it's all based on what they've been promising, the administration writ large, since day one. That is dramatically higher growth in this country. And so if you forecast out based on that, things look radically different than if you just forecast out based on the way things are right now.
All right, Catherine, let's get back to this. Just because the GDP number came out for the second quarter, final GDP came out at 3%, 3.1 technically, percent. The president has been promising 6%. Mnuchin himself said growth is going to take care of all the debt issues and the deficit issues with this thing. How believable is it that growth is going to take care of the deficit exploding nature of these tax cuts?
Not at all.
Okay.
It
all
is
right.
Not at all believable. Look, if you look at what the CBO, Congressional Budget Office, says, if you look at what the Fed says long-term growth rates are going to be, and I'm not talking quarter to quarter when it bounces around.
Yep.
Long-term, it's like 1.8%, 1.9%. There is no conceivable way we are going to get to 3%, which is what they had been promising, let alone 6%. I have this little rule of thumb that I repeat all the time, which is that The more growth a politician promises, the worse their tax plan probably
is.
Rampell's
rule.
I'm going to call it the Rampell
rule.
That's
totally good. Exactly. Capital R's all the way, yeah.
Yeah, because they need that growth to paper over the enormous cost of what they're trying to get the taxpayer to swallow.
Let me get to the corporate side of this thing, David. Lots of talk about repatriation, lots of talk about lowering the corporate rate. I think the number in here is 20% on corporate taxes that Gary Cohn said yesterday from the podium of the White House is the last and final and first and best, basically only offer they're going to make. How do you get there, 20% corporate taxes, without blowing yet another hole in the deficit?
Yeah, that would be very difficult. And you might be surprised to hear it's 20% because the president's been saying he wants it to be 15% for a very long time. You bring up a good point here, though, and that is there's a lot of stuff here that's subject to negotiation. And,
right. You
know, we've gone from one page to two pages to now nine pages from this group known as the Big Six. But the end result here, if we get to it, is going to be hundreds, if not more than 1,000 pages in length.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a lot left to do, and you see that when you look at this framework that was offered up earlier this week. A lot is being left to Congress to figure out, and there's going to be a lot of squabbling yet. And it strikes me, just talking to politicians, you know, a lot of Republican politicians are content that we're here. We're moving on to a point where we can have a debate over some of these issues. But it's early days yet, and, you know, there are promises here we're going to get through it October, November, have something by the end of the year, and I'm not going to bet on that.
Yeah, no, that's not happening, not with the budget and all the stuff that's got to happen in December. One of the things, Catherine, is going to be on the table for negotiation is this idea of the deductibility of state and local taxes. That is going to be contentious in the extreme because so many of us get money doing that, but also because of who it hits. How do we think those negotiations go down?
I think they're going to be very, very difficult. Look, basically all of the offsets that Republicans have been talking about are extremely contentious. When I say offsets, I mean things that are going to make this not cost quite as much.
Right.
So we've already written off the border adjustment tax, if anybody remembers that. You know, Obamacare was going to help basically through some complicated budget work reduce the amount that they would have to offset. Repealing Obamacare, that is. And this state and local tax deduction was also going to be another way that they were going to, you know, close a loophole and therefore reduce the cost. Except it not only does it primarily hit blue states, but there are Republicans in those blue states. There are Republican congressmen in New Jersey, for example, who are going to fight this tooth and nail. So I think it's very hard to imagine that any of these offsets are going to be easy to get through.
It is a long, long road from here to there. Catherine Rampell at the Washington Post, David Gura from Bloomberg in our bureaus in New York on a Friday afternoon. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Guy.
Thanks, Guy.
Tom Price is out as Secretary of Health and Human Services, resigned this afternoon over the charter flight scandal. Moral of the story here, don't take charter planes on the taxpayer's dime, and then when you get caught, offer to repay more than 13 cents on the dollar. On Wall Street today, well, wait, before I say that, let me say this. 9 years ago today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average. What happened? You remember? Think about it. I'll tell you later. Meanwhile, equities today, it's all good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The only issue that might affect more Americans than healthcare does is tax policy. And if you thought the lobbying was intense over repealing the Affordable Care Act, you ain't seen nothing yet. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports.
The GOP tax plan isn't a bill yet. It's nowhere close. But Jeff Barry has a name for it already.
The Lobbying Full Employment Act of 2017.
Barry teaches politics at Tufts University.
Every interest that is going to be affected is going to be well represented in Washington.
Oh, they already are.
We have governors, mayors, county officials, realtors, educators, firefighters, sheriffs.
Those are the people behind just one coalition, Americans Against Double Taxation. Andrew Konashewski is a spokesperson.
Our primary issue with the tax plan is that it seeks to eliminate the state and local tax deduction.
And don't forget about the bankers.
We think the direction that they're going is quite positive.
Rob Nichols is president of the American Bankers Association.
Those are our two top priorities, tax reform and regulatory modernization.
The Not One Penny Coalition was formed to lobby on tax reform literally last month. Michael Linden advises them.
My primary concern is that the GOP tax plan is a massive tax cut for rich people.
But the home builders are on board, happy they get to keep the low-income housing tax credit.
Right now, we're in support.
Jerry Howard heads the National Association of Home Builders. This is just the point of the end of the tip of the iceberg of groups with something to say. Jim Paterba teaches economics at MIT.
The fact that there are special interest groups organized along particular provisions in the tax code, as opposed to the total burden the taxpayers face, actually complicates the process of doing tax reform.
This, on top of a highly polarized Congress, does not bode well for tax reform. Again, Tufts' Jeff Barry.
I don't think it's going to happen. I think we'll get tax rate cuts and not a whole lot more.
It's no coincidence that we haven't had successful tax reform in 31 years. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
We didn't plan it this way, seriously. We didn't. But lobbying and general awareness of the state of things in Washington, D.C. is the through line of this next story as well. First, Facebook and now Twitter are in some congressional hot water over what the Russians did or might have done on their platforms. Lawmakers are calling for more transparency, voluntarily or required by regulation, whichever works. Marketplace's Rima Kreis looks at whether social media companies are ready for what might be coming.
Oh, yeah. They're prepared, says Tim Wu. He teaches communications law at Columbia Law School.
You know, Silicon Valley was once, you know, a bunch of geeks who like had never heard of the law or whatever. It's not like that at all anymore.
Facebook and Twitter, he says, have an army of people in suits. They're paying millions for seasoned public relations experts and powerful lobbyists who right now are trying to handle the Russian meddling problem on their own.
The first resort when you've made a big mistake is self-regulation. You know, don't worry, we got this, we can be trusted.
Nathan White is with Access Now, a digital advocacy rights organization in D.C. He says Facebook's been posting lots of jobs on the public policy side, and they're staffing up with politics in mind.
So we went from a Democratic administration to a Republican administration. So there's already going to be some transition because you want the people on your team to know how the process works, but also have connections.
Connections to dissuade lawmakers from a stricter path of regulation, like requiring social media companies to display who's paid for ads. But Tim Sparapani, a former director of public policy for Facebook, doesn't think specific regulations will be on the table soon.
You have the inability of people to focus on one type of curative measure that they would force on these companies.
In other words, this is such new territory that lawmakers haven't even agreed on a wish list for social media regulation yet. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Puerto Rico, as the president likes to say, is an island in the middle of the ocean. So rebuilding in the wake of Hurricane Maria is going to be difficult and expensive. And that is going to affect, in the president's view, how rebuilding is going to get done.
Ultimately, the government of Puerto Rico will have to work with us to determine how this massive rebuilding effort will end up being one of the biggest ever, will be funded and organized. And what we will do with the tremendous amount of existing debt already on the island.
So two things about that piece of tape from the president's speech this morning at the National Association of Manufacturers. First of all, not a mention has yet been made by anybody of Texas or Florida's existing debt in terms of their hurricane relief. And number two, if you put it in terms of dollars and cents, what does that mean for what Puerto Rico is going to look like? We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to sort that one out.
A local government's financial situation ordinarily does not affect economic damage assessments or the level of funding for rebuilding. So says Robin Keegan, who ran the Louisiana Recovery Authority after Hurricane Katrina. She says right now in the U.S. territory, federal and local officials are in the field.
There's an economic analysis being run of the housing, how much would that cost to rebuild, number of businesses, if they've lost all of their crops, the revenue lost.
Keegan says FEMA pays for the immediate recovery needs, and Congress often passes additional funding to upgrade housing and infrastructure. After small disasters, FEMA picks up 75% of the cost, with local governments covering the rest. But after Katrina, the feds paid 100%, says Andy Coplin at the Greater New Orleans Foundation.
The president and his administration have the ability to waive that match if they think the state and local government doesn't have the resources or the devastation is so broad.
And with its massive debt and aging infrastructure, Puerto Rico's capacity to contribute is severely limited, says Ted Hampton at Moody's Investor Service.
If the federal government provides too little funding or support, things in Puerto Rico could get much worse. And one of the risks there is that we would see a massive exodus, and that would really shrink Puerto Rico's economic base.
Which would make it more difficult for Puerto Rico to deal with its debt and get on the road to recovery. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You know, it's not like beer and spirits where they're able to make their products all year round. It's, you know, now or never for the year.
You all right with a little smoke in your wine? But first, let's do the numbers. On this Friday, the Dow Industrial's up 23 points, about a 10%, closed to 22,405. NASDAQ climbed 42.6 tenths percent, 64.95. The S&P 500 up 9 points. 0.3%, 25.19. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow up 0.2%, the NASDAQ up 1%, the S&P 500 up 0.6%. We talked about Facebook and Twitter. Investors don't care about no regulation. Facebook up 1.2% today. Twitter advanced about 0.1%. Tyson Foods is forecasting strong profits thanks to strong beef sales. Tyson cooked up 7.6% today. Chicken producer Pilgrim's Pride roosted in the same place, unchanged. Just did that to get to say roosted. That's all. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.33%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is...
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace, I'm Kai Rizdahl. There was an article in the New York Times the other day that got a whole lot of buzz online. Men in Silicon Valley who are upset at all the women in tech now. Now, if you know anything about tech and women in tech and Silicon Valley, you know being upset about all the women in tech right now is a difficult argument to make stick. Sexism and sexual harassment and gender inequality are far closer to the norm than anything else. Yet there is a small but growing group of men in tech who are unhappy with efforts to get more women working in that slice of this economy. Nellie Bowles covers Silicon Valley and the culture of Silicon Valley for the New York Times. Nellie, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Silicon Valley has been hostile is one word, difficult for women is another one for a very long time. The events you describe in this article, though, seem a step beyond hostile, no?
Yeah. It's been a very problematic place for women, for people of color, for many years. And I think that what we've seen in the last year is finally people are kind of facing consequences for rampant sexual harassment, for rampant discrimination, and in part as a result of the success of the women in tech movement, there's been a backlash.
Yeah, tell me about this guy, James Altizer, who has been organizing pushback events, I guess you could call them, against women in technology for a while. It used to be just him and a couple of guys, and now it's, you say, crowds of hundreds.
Yeah, I mean, you're seeing ideas that were fringe ideas or were whispered more quietly, but that I think had been infused in a lot of these companies. You're seeing them start to become emboldened and grow. You're seeing more activity on things like the Red Pill, which is a Reddit site for men who believe they've sort of woken up to women's oppression of them. Or like in the story I described, like MGTOW, which is another kind of online forum for men who are in favor of living totally separately from women.
It's MGTOW, you should spell it out, right? It's Men Going Their Own Way, MGTOW.
Men Going Their Own Way. James is a kind of interesting case because he's had these philosophies for a long time, and then now he's sort of seeing that he's not so alone and that there are a lot of people who are thinking this way and who are talking about it and meeting together. I didn't realize how big it had gotten.
Is there something about technology that makes it a place that is rife with discrimination against women and people of color and minorities?
I don't know. I think there are a lot of answers to give. The kind of classic one is, oh, it's the pipeline. There aren't enough women who are getting computer science degrees. I think that one's kind of BS, honestly. I think a lot of what we've seen in the Valley in the last few years is just like real basic bad behavior, like the sexual harassment stuff and the way that women are kind of pushed out of the workplace here. You know, a lot of startups don't have very good HR systems, so there's that, like, very basic thing. There's no one to go to. There's no one to really report to when things go wrong.
So you get the startups, and they don't have HR, and that's great. But then you get companies like Uber, which explodes, still doesn't have an HR system, and then gets into systemic problems that at least partially cost the CEO and the co-founder his job. You have a place like SoFi, where it was described as being a fraternity house, which is nothing that you want in a corporate atmosphere. And I just wonder, and, you know, this interview will get pushback from men in technology, I'm sure, but I wonder if there's something about the technology culture that makes it so difficult for them to accept women as peers and colleagues and equals in a professional setting.
There's so many reasons. I think part of it is a lot of workplaces aren't seen as workplaces. Like, there's a big effort throughout Silicon Valley to kind of blend work and personal life and home, and you do everything in the office. And so, like, for example, James Damore's Google memo. Like, he wrote James Damore got fired from Google after writing a memo that women don't like tech as much for biological reasons. That he posted in a workplace forum, I think, tells you a lot about Silicon Valley and how it views the lines between, like, what's the office and what's, like, your personal belief that actually is not okay in an office.
Nellie Bowles, writing in the New York Times on men and women in Silicon Valley. Nellie, thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you so much.
It's been a rough year for wildfires out here in the American West. More than 1 million acres have burned in Montana, Oregon, Washington, and California. With those fires, of course, have come ash and smoke and haze that have lingered for weeks. All that bad air has been a worry for people working outside, agriculture workers in particular, and some crops as well. Winemakers are keeping an eye on the grape harvest. Molly Solomon has that story from Oregon Public Broadcasting.
On a clear day, Jocelyn Bentley Prestwich can see major local landmarks, like the Columbia River, from the vineyard she works at in Hood River, Oregon. But for long stretches this summer, the entire town was cloaked in heavy smoke.
You couldn't even see past those trees right there.
Oh my God.
The ones that are starting to turn.
Bentley Prestwich points a couple yards away to the trees that line the perimeter. She's the marketing manager of the 7-acre Cathedral Ridge Winery. The smoke came from the Eagle Creek Fire along the Columbia River Gorge about 20 miles away. The fire covered thousands of acres at its peak, and at one point even halted commercial boat traffic on the river.
We're still, I believe, with the fire marshal still has us at level one. But
Bentley Prestwich takes me outside to a row of Riesling grapes ripening on the vine.
They're still fairly young. You can tell generally by the size of their little trunk here. And I'm going to say these are, well, let's have a taste. They're still a little tart, but they're good.
The taste is an important factor. All the smoke and ash that was hanging in the air could easily transfer to the grapes, potentially changing the quality of the wine.
This is a huge thing for the wine industry because Oregon and Washington have these major wine industries, and so this is something that everybody's taking very seriously.
Two-thirds of all wine produced in the country is grown in California, Oregon, and Washington. And U.S. wine sales brought in $38 billion last year. But with wildfires becoming all too common, some growers are turning to science for help. Thomas Hennig-Kling is the director of the Viticulture and Enology Department at Washington State University. His department is the only one in the country leading research on what happens when grapes are exposed to smoke for extended periods of time. He says more often, they develop a taste or smell called smoke taint.
These wine taints are described as sometimes campfire, but also ashtray. So those aromas, of course, are not attractive in a wine.
Hennig-Kling says his department's research could eventually lead to a regional response system. He wants to figure out a way to know when grapes are getting too much smoke exposure.
Wine is a delicate business because, you know, you only have this window once a year to make your product.
Michael Kaiser is the vice president of Wine America, a national trade association that advocates for the wine industry.
You know, it's not like beer and spirits where they're able to make their products all year round. It's, you know, now or never for the year.
And while there are plenty of powerhouse vineyards in the West, there are also a lot of smaller enterprises. And for them, one bad harvest could mean a significant hit to the bottom line. Scott Steingraper is the president of the Southern Oregon Winery Association.
Every vintage, you want that to be the best it can. Your reputation relies on a consistent mark of excellent wine.
And, he says, it's not something winemakers can afford to ignore. With climate scientists predicting that hotter, drier summers are the new normal, vineyards will have to be prepared. In Hood River, I'm Molly Solomon for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, the answer to my Today in Wall Street History trivia question that we started with. Let me give you a hint, all right? If I say TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, does that ring a bell? Maybe. The big financial crisis bailout plan originally authorized at $700 billion. You remember how it failed in the House the first time it came up? Yeah, that was 9 years ago today. The Dow fell 777 points that day, the biggest point drop ever. All right, we got to go a little tight on time, but just for fun, the Dow, 9 years ago today, 10,365. So how about that? All right, it's a Friday. We're out of here. The theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizda. Have yourselves a good weekend, everybody. No, have a great weekend, all right? We'll be back on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.